Talk given Saturday, 19th April, 1975. What we considered at our last meeting here in March marks the climax of our work during these last 13 years. Recall the subject matter. What is meant by the state of communion? A state which is extremely difficult to put into words. But insofar as it is possible to do so, we tried to give a verbal form and a certain vision of what the state of communion is. The state of communion which is the ultimate fruition of each and every single human being. Very, very few people throughout the centuries ever realized that state. That is the way of life. That is how things are. We may have thousands of musical people. Hundreds amongst them may become composers. But only one here, one there, is the outstanding genius who leaves works of immortal beauty, the embodiment of transcendent realization in some way or other. So too is it with our lives. Mankind goes on, moved by two tremendous forces. One is the irresistible but non-compulsive drawing power of transcendence itself, and the other is the energy drive of nature working towards that fulfillment. The action of transcendence is action in eternity, creative action. The action of nature is a purposive drive spread through time. And you and I, as human beings, as ordinary mortals, have this power of choice, have the power to perceive what this drive is on the part of nature, what this invitation, this welcoming, longing invitation is on the part of transcendence. We have the power to perceive these things if we really care. And we make our own choice. Now, through these years, we have dealt with certain main aspects of this great pilgrimage of mankind in this world. It is for us to ask ourselves, how far have we understood this? Are our sights set upon transcendence in fact, or only as a pious wish, or as a mere emotional, intellectual indulgence? There is no one who is going to demand an account from any one of us. We are born, we live through our lives, and die as separate individuals. There is a disappearance. Mankind reaps the full fruit, be it a perfect fruit or be it an ill fruit, a rotten fruit. Mankind reaps. You and I, as individuals and in association with all people and all things around us, sow those seeds which come to ripeness in their own time, sometimes in our own lifetime, sometimes not in our own lifetime. Now, what have we done through the years? Because remember that at our last group weekend here in March, at the end of March, we tried to grasp a vision of, if one may say so, the end point, fruition, fulfillment, and what it means in actual fact. For the sake of those who were not present then, let me just say one or two things to recapitulate. The man who has become truly man, grown to full manhood, grown out of his usual subhuman state, is the one who is perpetually aware in terms of totality. He is no longer aware of existence in terms of an isolative self-consciousness. He is, to use the language of the mystics, unselfed. And only in being unselfed, by virtue of the fact, therefore, that he is at one with all that is, he has realized self in the supreme sense. The self which is unself. The purified ego, the distinctive individual being, utterly free of all egoism. And as such, he is aware of his whole life, 24 hours of the day, in a manner which is quite transcendent to the manner in which we ordinary mortals are aware. This is the great transformation. This transformation in consciousness, as the religions have put it, as the theologian would say, he is aware of this world, including himself, not as a separate human being, who is not yet fully related to the totality, but he is aware in the manner that God is aware. I'm using the word God as a convenient word. Therefore, if any one of us is like that, when I am looking at an object, it is transcendence itself which is looking through my eyes at that object. I, the separate self, the sub-man, the sub-human, seeing that object, see it as separate in itself. I do not see all its relationships. I see it with the eyes of desire, with the eyes that distort its true, its eternal reality. But when manhood is fully realized, when one is unselfed, one sees with the eyes, those sleepless, immortal eyes of transcendence itself. Then you see the object not only as that particular finite object with its particular characteristics and so forth, but you see all the material world embodied in that object. You see the totality of materiality embodied in every single manifestation of materiality. You see how different the situation becomes? There can be no grasping of that object then. There can be no hurting of that object, no misuse of it, no wrong relationship to it. This is purity, this is perfection, which man alone on this globe can realize. Infinity sees finitude through your own eyes. And in that is the supreme expression, the final, ultimate material expression of transcendent love, wisdom, beauty, pure goodness. When transcendence looks through your eyes, there is no problem for you through whom transcendence is looking, of acceptance or rejection. Totality sees its own totality, its own beauty, its own marvel and wonder. And it sees and knows it in fullness, not in terms of mere change, of the passage of time, of being born and dying, of beginning and ending, but in terms of eternity. And because the Holy Ones through the ages have seen like that, there are phrases, to use the Christian phrase for instance, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. You can't give an intellectual meaning to it. Intellect is completely transcended in that living, experienced awareness. If we were to use Buddhistic terms, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade is there in its totality, in the become, the born, the made. So too, when you look at a person, how does one look? Free of all grasping, free of differentiation. You see mankind embodied in each and every person. Mankind as a whole. And since mankind is still growing, evolving towards man made in the image of God, again, to use a very convenient phrase, you see the what we call the imperfections there. But because you yourself are utterly pure and free of all imperfection, of all sorrow and evil, you also see man in the image of God imprisoned there. So you cannot hurt the bad man. You cannot reward the good man. If you see with the eyes, which are the eyes of transcendence, how can you hurt, punish on the one hand, or reward, approve on the other hand? You have transcended duality. You see, something like this, We went into more considerations, but otherwise I'll be repeating the last meeting. We'll go on. These are the implications and the significances of the state of communion, the condition of communion. And to be aware in this state all through the day, together with the appropriate expression of this state in our thought, feeling, speech, and action throughout the day, is the meaning of human fruition. And the meaning of this human fruition is expressed in the Bible, for instance, in the New Testament, as the manhood being lifted up to the Godhead. It's expressed in terms like liberation, moksha, in the Hindu teachings. It is expressed as the state of the Arahant, the perfected Holy One, the one who is no longer liable to delusion, whose mind is utterly purified, whose daily life is utterly blameless, as presented in Buddhism. In Zarathustrianism, he is the embodiment of the supreme characteristics which are ascribed to Ahura Mazda, the Supreme Being. That he is the embodiment of the good thought, the good word, the good deed. But remember, good not in our merely dualistic sense. Not within the sphere of ambivalence, but in a manner which has completely transcended all our ambivalence. And transcending does not mean to be wholly other than and separated from either aspect of the ambivalence, but to have integrated the two aspects of that ambivalence into a whole which is completely subsumed in the transcendent. Such is the vision, as far as I can put it into words, of man's fulfillment. What have we done then? So far, we came to the point of expressing this in words definitely at the end of March. 13 years of work. Have we realized some of the simple aspects of this kind of fulfillment? Have we changed in the right way so that we have really grown towards this man, the man in the image of God, the one called in Buddhism the Uttarapurisho, the further man, as it has been sometimes translated, not a very happy translation, I'm afraid, means he who has gone beyond, totally beyond. But in going totally beyond, he has not cut himself off. In the realization of his perfection, all mankind is that much more perfect. How far have we gone? Have we learnt the simple lessons? Or are we still children playing on the seashore of endless worlds? Just playing. This is very important, because the world is in tribulation, in terrible tribulation. And its material tribulation, its political, economic, and all the rest of it, all that tribulation is the expression, the outward final expression of an inward disease, a deadly disease. Always look to the roots when the tree becomes bad. And the roots, remember, are hidden. They are under the ground. And the roots of you and I as human beings are the spirit, the mind, the soul. Look, take any word you like. There is the root. Let us look at one or two simple things. You know how I've always said, sometimes apparently in fun, but meaning it very seriously, that that the first rule of the spiritual life is not to take leave of good sense. Good sense. And I have always carefully explained that good sense in the religious context, in the context of real humanity, that is utterly different from what we call common sense. Most of the world has common sense, using the word common in its pejorative meaning, its derogatory meaning. It's common, it's not of high quality, its quality is bad. Most of the world has that. And therefore, the world is greedy, self-loving, violent, untruthful, wicked in the real sense. Let's have no illusions about this. The race of mortals, especially at present, is in a very sorry state, losing its moral backbone above all. Such mortals cannot possibly exercise good sense. When the mind and the heart are pure, when there is intelligent, dispassionate perception of the truth of things, persons, and situations as they actually are, then one can exercise good sense. Because good sense here, right down at our organic biological level, our psychophysical level, is the ultimate material expression, almost, of the sense of transcendence which is embodied in each and every one of us. And it is for us, especially through good sense, to let that light burst into flame and shine like a star in our little world, our environment, and through our own lives. Now, has good sense grown in us? Or are we still the thralls of common sense, which means the sense that functions in terms of self-orientation, which is the servant of the pleasure drive, which is the result of intellectual functioning where intellect is the slave of desire? This is what religion means in practice, in reality. Otherwise, it is talk. It is an emotional, intellectual indulgence, which is always self-oriented. It is selfish. It's egoistic. That's the first point. Second, have we learned to be quiet and silent? Or do we in our everyday lives chatter ceaselessly? The usual inconsequential, stupid, foolish chatter, excusing it under the name of being sociable or whatever it is. When we speak, do we speak words that are altogether truthful, that are not harsh, not misleading, not malicious, not slanderous, not idle gossip, tied up with the turmoil and the folly and the evil of the world? Look at the tremendous part played by the spoken and printed word in human life. It is the most powerful mischief maker in the world. It is also the most wonderful and specifically human expression of the vision and reality of transcendence when we are engaged in talk which is concerned with what really matters. Have we learned to be silent and quiet? Or do we burst into a room and immediately let fly a barrage of useless words? And what are those words about? We can never repeat this too often. Every single sentence probably contains the word I at least once, sometimes 10 times. Do we speak them gently, considerately? Do we ask ourselves, is what I am going to say or wish to say truthful, kind, helpful and useful in the immediate situation? Or is it just a senseless imposition of my ego upon the situation? This business of speech is extremely important. Because when I am silent, this particular psychophysical organism, which is so self-involved, when I am silent, the wordless, inspiring speech of transcendent reality sings its song of life, if we have ears to hear. This silence, this quietness, is the golden gateway which opens out our awareness out of the prison house of the limited, the mortal, the ill, into the harmony, the perfection, and the beauty of the infinite, the immortal. Then we realize the meaning of immortality. Because all the flow of idle speech is a death chatter. It's the chatter of the dying. That which is dying through illness, through pain, through sorrow, through frustration, through grief, through fear, through anxiety. But if that chatter ceases, if we are just quiet within ourselves, then what happens? Self-concern disappears. We do everything, we listen to anything, always interpreting it in relation to ourself at the moment. And what is ourself? A bundle of desires, a bundle of conditioned states of mind and emotion, a bundle of psychical imbalance and unease. Isn't that what just really what we are? In our ordinary subhuman mortal state. But when I get silent, then, with the cessation of this chatter, this twisted, distorted, cacophonous I, making a noise within itself and imposing that noise on the environment, suddenly is well. Suddenly. You don't need to go to psychiatrists and anybody or anybody at all. You don't need to listen to me or to anybody at all. If you keep quiet, the poetry of the speech of the transcendent will flow within you. And that will answer every question that rises up inside you. It will answer every question, because when that happens, your mode of awareness, your state of alert awakenedness now, is such that pure intelligence, which is there within you because you are a living being, functions and sees the truth of the situation at once. And it sees the truth of the situation without being distorted, because it is not distorted by one's own conditioning. One is freed of one's own conditioning. And you see the fact as the fact. And in seeing the fact as the fact, the action which accompanies that seeing is pure action and right action. And it is free action, because it is no longer related to one's personal desires or greeds or ambitions or fears or any such ill thing. That is why. Why do you think all the great scriptures of the world emphasize this silence? That is the significance of this silence. This silence means that you have overpassed death. You have freed yourself from all unease and strain. Consider carefully these things. Work them out when you are by yourself, the implications of them. It will mean, amongst other things, the relinquishing, the right renouncing, and the relinquishing of all that we cling to. Our beliefs, our ambitions, our convictions, our pursuits, our pleasures, and our follies and ill doing. Why do I go on doing ill? Because I cling to my own ill doing. These are very difficult things to penetrate into. As you listen to such words, the intellect may agree or it may disagree. But whether the intellect agrees or disagrees, remember that this intellect is a conditioned thing. It is always the slave, both sometimes consciously but always unconsciously, of inner desire. The intellectual assent or disagreement, dissent, is of no avail. It is very deep. But if you remain quiet, then you will find that all ill just falls off you. Make a ball of snow or of sea sand. You have to wet it a bit, of course. Make a ball and throw it at a rock. Did you ever manage to split the rock that way? It just falls off. And you laugh. We did that when we were children, didn't we? So, be free of all that the intellect will raise up. Because the intellect will raise up only that which is the known, which is past, which is not now, and only the eternal now, the immediate now, is the living moment. On that side is death. On this side is the unborn. The immediate now is the living moment. And if you or I cling to the past, or that means to all that is known, and so forth, we are carrying the burden of innumerable corpses. And in carrying that burden, we besmirch the now. Because remember that in the actual immediate now, perpetual creative action proceeds apace. And the total universe is created anew in every single split second of existence. And that newness is lost. And you might say, but how can I let all the known go by? I won't know how to cook my next meal if I let all the known go by. No, you would know how to cook the next meal. You will lose none of your techniques, none of your skills. You see why? Because techniques and skills are built into one's psychophysical being as natural faculties. They have become second nature. You love music. All right. You have a gift, we'll say, for playing a piano. Right you are. You practice your scales and arpeggios and your studies and all the works of the great composers, and you become perfect master of it all. Do you cling to all the elements which contributed towards that study, which was a living process, which ended up, culminated in, came to perfect fruition in you as a supreme musician? You and your piano are no longer separate, no longer different. When you're playing, it is transcendence playing through you. And every time you play, the interpretation has just that magic of newness. Although that is the thousandth time you're playing it to your friends or on the concert platform. So, none of your skills are lost. They are inbuilt as faculty. Now, if you let go clinging to the intellectual forms which you build around, then pure intelligence, the living power within you, functions all the time. And you are no longer impeded by false values in anything and everything that you do in life. You don't start calculating, oh, I must be careful, mustn't hurt her, say this to that man, otherwise my husband will lose that contract which they are about to sign. All these, you know, the stupidity of the world. We live by the grace of God, by the grace of transcendence, not by the contracts we sign. The word which I give unto another, I must fulfill. Yes. If I promise to love, honor, and obey somebody, right? I will love, honor, and obey somebody. It works itself out and comes to transcendent rightness. If what rightness I can see now is perfectly fulfilled. This is the important thing. When you get silent and quiet, you will find that all the imposed beliefs and doctrines, all the imposed constraining moralities restrictive moralities will be out. Why and how? Not in the sense of, I can now do what I like. That is not freedom. That is supreme bondage. Freedom begins at the peak point of self-restraint. But when you are quiet and silent, this clamorous, nuisance-producing selfness of the self is out. Then you have become utterly free of this most imprisoning factor of our life, do what I like. That which is the will of the transcendent itself functions through you. Then you don't have to undergo the conflict, thy will, O Lord, not mine, or is it going to be my will, O Lord, not thine, or can't you just let me off this time, next time it will be different, you'll have your innings. All that rubbish will be completely out. You know, you have to experience this sort of thing and the extraordinary inner peace and happiness that comes up. You just let go. And when you let go, you are no longer held in bondage by that which you grasped. This is so difficult really to see. So, one naturally at first experiences inward distress. I am a faithful Hindu, I am a faithful Zarathustrian, or I'm a Mohammedan, or I'm a Catholic, or I'm this, that, or the other. And what this man says, etc., seems to go against all the doctrines which have been handed on to me as absolute truth. No doctrine, either in its conceptual form, and still less in its verbal formulation, is absolute truth. If it were, it would never need to undergo change. But study the history of all the religious doctrines of the world and see how they just undergo change. Why? How? So, recognize the doctrine, the verbal formulation, as the external wrapping. Take, for instance, this physical body of ours. We say it is alive. It is alive. Then there comes the day, the moment, when I take my last breath, and this very body, which was alive, is said to be dead. This is the situation in which this body is an external wrapping. Is it not? Insofar as the manifestation of a living human being was concerned. The matter of the body is still alive, actually. Science has come to the point where it is showing clearly there's no such thing as dead matter. No such thing. So that's the marvel of science. But as far as the manifestation of a living human being is concerned, the moment this body is dead, as we say, this body has become the external wrapping of this mysterious thing, life. So, doctrines and dogmas are like that. out of the inward living realization which goes utterly beyond all formulation and all restriction, in mind and consciousness in its free depth, out of that comes the external manifestation of it as concepts and as words. But don't cling to the concepts and words, because that which produced the concepts and the words are this mysterious, this unknown and unknowable transcendent reality, which is the supreme thing. So, have we learned to be quiet and silent? We started with good sense. This is the second point. And the most important point in the religious life, which means simply the human life. Never separate the religious life from the secular life or the everyday life. And the religious life is not a case of between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock when I do my meditation or go to church or some such thing. Perpetually here and now I am meditating. Am I not communing with you at the moment? Or at least attempting to. Giving my life, my energy for it, towards it. Wholly, completely, unreservedly. Not asking anything, not expecting anything, hoping nothing. Why should I? Does the sun expect, demand, hope that we shall do this, that, or the other when it shines? It just shines. It doesn't bother a hoot what we do. It just shines. The glory of God pouring itself out. That is how we should be, surely. What an object lesson. So, if we are quiet and silent, all these marvelous things take place. And we have taken the most important step into our real heritage to be man, the true human, the happy creator. This is what human means. Have we done any of this? Have we had any realization of it? I mean realization. Not just thinking about it, not just talking about it or musing about it. Not just saying to oneself, This is really wonderful. I must live this way. You can't impose a must upon yourself. It's only the nuclear forces within the nucleus of an atom which impose a must upon the protons and neutrons which compose that nucleus and hold it together. There is no other must, and even that can be disrupted. The irresistibility of transcendence, something I mentioned. And why is transcendence irresistible? Because transcendence, God, say, use what word you like, is infinitely resilient. In this infinite resilience, it cannot be hurt, it cannot be lessened, it cannot be constrained. Isn't that so? And in mind and consciousness, if we do remain silent and are freed of the tyranny of our egoism and our selfness, we also become infinitely resilient. than our particular desires. Oh, I must have this for the home and the house, this for the husband, that for the wife. We can't live like that, you know. We've got to live up to this standard. What standard? A standard of squandering our energies like the Nibelungans, you see, in order to maintain a standard of expense. I've got to have that £29,000 Rolls Royce, you know, that's the latest thing. I can't go in a Ford. I can't afford a Ford. Standard? Perhaps we can spell the word, but its meaning, bless our hearts, we don't know. There is only one real standard, and it is a standard which cannot be measured. There is no measure for it. It is transcendence itself. It is life itself in its abundance and its unspeakable beauty and wonder. You see, if you can only let this really go inside you, all your problems cease to be your problems. They remain there as problems, but they are no longer your problem or my problem. The personal element being out, then the situation can be dealt with. You can act in the situation in the right way, and that is all there is to it. But you see the difference to your own mind and heart. You are at peace. The house caught fire, this lovely piano burnt away, all the books, and some of them are irreplaceable, they all got burnt up. All right. But when the fire breaks out, I don't rush frantically here and there trying to... I do the needful, all that is possible to the utmost degree, yes? But if the mind within is free, if that fire is not my problem, but the problem of the whole situation, then this remains at peace afterwards. You see, the fact is the fact. I managed to save the tie that my wife presented to me, and I'm quite happy. I know the sort of question that crops up. Yes, yes, not all very nice for you to say so, but I'd like to see you do it. All right, then I'll be nasty and say, I'd like to see you take a match and set fire to the house. You see, this is the meaning of the religious life. Have we grown towards it in the course of the years? Have we gone through that change, which means the transformation of the subhuman, the sick psyche, the ill creature, into a true man? I suggest, just let the mind dwell quietly upon these things. Good sense and its implications, and being quiet and silent. And above all, remember the words of the Varaha Upanishad, where three times in succession it is reiterated, practice silence, practice silence, practice silence. And at each reiteration some new thing is added on there. And with that silence, you will know happiness and fulfillment.